Good afternoon. My name is Linda Davis. This is December 15th, 2009, and I'm interviewing Major General Verna Fairchild. So we want to know everything that you've done over the last 40 years, General Fairchild. And what brought you into the military to begin with, and what is your working background?
Probably the uniqueness of it is I was not from a military family. I was interested in the military off and on for whatever reason, you know.
From a young age?
Yes. Probably maybe high school, you know, and that might have been just because I liked the looks of some of the uniforms. Had no plans to go. My background is I started out as a nurse. I went to a 3-year nursing program.
What school?
At Deaconess Hospital School of Nursing in Evansville, Indiana. It was one of the last diploma schools to exist, and they closed after a few years after I graduated from there in 1962, and I'm not sure what the date was or anything. After I graduated from there was...
What year was that?
1962.
Okay.
I graduated from there, worked at Deaconess Hospital in their psychiatric unit. In a couple years became the what they then called the head nurse of the psychiatric unit. I think now they're referred to as charge nurses or something more exotic. During that few short years immediately after, I even dated the Air Force recruiter a few times in Evansville. I don't even remember his name. It must not have been too serious. And then my roommate was, we were both going to join. We went down and talked, but that was where it ended. Well, a few years later, in 1968, I was charge of the psychiatric unit at Deaconess. And in those days, it was rare to have a male nurse. And I had one male nurse that... was a real asset on a psychiatric unit, as you can well imagine.
Oh, yeah.
And he was about 1 or 2 years out of nurse's training himself, was expecting a draft notice any time. Of course, I didn't want him to get drafted, so I started talking to him about, you know, why don't you join the reserve? And I said, you know, I'll even call and go with you to talk to them. And
how old were you at that point?
I was 24, 25, I believe. So I set us up an appointment for Saturday. He and I went up to the Air Force Reserve at McCollar Air Reserve Base at Columbus, Indiana. And they pretty much said, they didn't have any nurses at the time. They said, if you'll join too, we'll make sure his paperwork gets processed before he gets his draft notice. I thought, well, that's a nice outlet from working acute psychiatric unit on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, I can do anything for a year. So I said, okay. Well, within, I got a direct commission. Like I said, I think I was 25 at the time, which meant I had a few years' experience under my belt, so I got a direct commission as a first lieutenant. I never was a second lieutenant in the Air Force Reserve. That was in March of 1968. In April 1968, before either of us had uniforms, any training or anything, I got a call at the hospital one day. I was down in the basement of the hospital at a meeting, and my unit clerk came rushing in, just barged right into the meeting, said, excuse me, my maiden name was East, said, excuse me, Miss East, but Uncle Sam's on the phone for you. And I thought, uh-oh. It was my hospital commander from St. Louis, a physician from St. Louis, Missouri, calling to tell me that our unit had in fact been activated and we were to report that I would get my orders in writing, but that was the official notification that we were to report. And I can't remember, I think it was in 30 days, 30 or 60 days. You know, that's,
and you hadn't
that's
had any
been
training
a while.
Or anything
nothing,
yet.
Nothing. And it just really scared me to death. I thought, oh, Lord, what have I done? But, you know, I decided that that's why I joined, and so, you know, I do what I needed to do. Well, the thing that I was the most concerned about was I had to go home and tell my mother. At that time, I was living with my mother. My roommate had moved out of our apartment, so I'd given it up, and my father had died, so I'd moved. My mother had moved to Evansville, so I lived with she and my younger sister. And I had told her when I joined, she didn't much like the idea. And I said, well, you know, I quit anytime I want to because I'm, you know, I'm not drafted. So when I went home and told her, she said, well, just quit. And I said, well, there's one thing I failed to mention, that once you're activated, you can't quit then. She was so angry with me. I have one brother, and she said, here, I've always worried about my son. Little did I think I'd ever have to worry about my daughters going off to war. So she was not happy at all. But we made, I think that next week after we were notified, the male nurse and I and his, I think it was his girlfriend. I don't know if it was girlfriend or fiance. That was before they were married. Made a fast trip to Scott Air Force Base in St. Louis, which was about 3 hours or so from Evansville. Bought uniforms, neither of us knew what we were doing. And that was probably my first episode of realizing that females weren't treated the same as the males in the military. We went to the clothing sales at Scott Air Force Base. There were three females working there, I believe, that day. They totally ignored me, helped him, you know, and I didn't have a clue what I needed or anything about it. I just knew I needed uniforms. So finally, bit by bit, you know, they helped me, and I got what I needed to have. And we went.
Did that one incident that frame the whole sexist image of the military at that point, did it make you feel like that you had to do more, be more, whatever, to get attention?
No. You know, I grew up in the days, as a student nurse, we were taught that you stood up when a doctor entered the nurse's station and gave him your chair. If you started onto an elevator and there was a doctor standing there, you stood back and let him get on the elevator first. And, you know, that was just fact of life. Didn't bother me. You know, I chose to be a nurse and thought, well, you know, that's the way it is. That's the way it is. And I, you know, didn't pay attention to it.
Didn't affect you one way or the other?
No, other than I was irritated the day I was trying to buy uniforms, didn't know what I was trying to do. And it took more effort on my part to get the help that I needed. And they didn't sell me anything that I wasn't supposed to have. So I guess be thankful for small things. But at that same time, I was had started working on my bachelor's degree in nursing at the University of Evansville. And I was carrying 10 hours at night, working full time. My brother was in Chicago and getting married in June, and I was going to be in the wedding. And here I was leaving for who knew when, who knew where, and for how long. And, you know, I kind of thought, well, I'm not exerting myself on the school business if I can't finish they were on quarter system at the time. That's how long ago it was.
Did you get a military deferment? In ability to drop the classes, or did you just finish it out?
I ended up finishing out because 3 days before we were supposed to report, it was on the radio, and then later the next day I got a letter or written orders saying they were only going to take the air crews, the flying operations, and at that point in time the rest of us had the choice of going on active duty or, you know, just remaining in reserve status. Well, the hospital had not been able to replace me, and so they were thrilled to death that you know, I was probably not going to go. And, of course, I had a lot of money invested in by taking 10 hours at night.
Sure.
So I opted to stay there. A lot of our veterinarian in the unit had contracted his practice app. He went on. Some of those folks had given up jobs or, you know, contracted their practice out, and they were at the point of no return. Those folks went to various Air Force bases wherever they were assigned. The air crew of the group went to Vietnam, flew the what they called the C-119 mini gunships, and they made the news. They were there for 6 months, I believe. They made the news for some operation on the ground. They flew a pattern, a circular pattern, for I forget how many hours, and held strobe lights on an area that they were doing surgery. You know, I've forgotten the other details, but the big thing was that after 6 months in Vietnam and you know what that was like, they all came home safely.
That's
which
amazing.
Was a real coup, you know, at that point in time with the casualty rate, what it was in Vietnam. But, you know, as I proceeded through my career, my active duty peers had been, a large percentage of the nurses had been to Vietnam. And I was actually disappointed once I got over the fact that I wasn't going anywhere and the realization that I had to catch up on the school that I'd let slide for a few weeks. I really was sorry that I didn't go on. But, you know, I would have wanted to have gone to Vietnam had I gone in.
You think you would have?
You know, I don't know. It just, it was such an individual thing, you know. In the military, you have all these written plans for everything, but then when it comes down to it, sometimes they follow the plan, sometimes they don't. So, you know, I don't know, but I to this day am sorry that I did not go. Had I been there, I'd probably wish that I'd never seen the place. One of my friends talked about getting off the airplane and the humid, hot air and thinking, my gosh, you know, what have I come to, that kind of thing. And, you know, she functioned and went
right on.
She
made it back okay,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. You know, one thing with nursing is that to this day, even though there are a lot of very few jobs anymore that that females can't do, nurses have always been in the midst of war. You know, it's just a fact, and it's not a discussion as whether you'll be in or near combat. You know, you're there at the front lines or very close behind, and so, you know, we never entered into that big discussion at that time, at least. When I joined the reserve in 1968, the group, I want to say, was like 1,300 people, which was 1,299 men and me. They didn't know Bacolod was a reserve base that set outside Columbus, Indiana, by, I don't know, 3 to 5 miles kind of thing it was into town. We went for the weekend when we did our monthly military training. They didn't have a place for me to stay. So for a while, they paid for me to stay at a motel in town. And then they decided they were getting tired of paying that. And I said, well, you figure it out. You know, so they had rows of barracks, and they had made the officers were, you know, one or two person barracks. So they fixed up, by that time there was a lady who was, I think she was a school teacher, and there were two groups in a wing. And, like, I was in the 930th, she was in the 931st. So they fixed up one unit at the end of one of those barracks that had its own bathroom. So I was there on our weekend, and she was there on their weekend. They finally got that taken care of. I met my husband in the Air Force Reserve. you know, what a nice choice with all that number. Plus, being in the hospital, you can check their records too. They didn't know what if they'd had a nurse in that unit before. I don't recall if they had it been a number of years, and they really didn't even know what to do with us, even though they wanted, you know, they recruited us very heavily. I started out, my first official assignment was the unit training officer, which was, you know, appropriate to train all the medics. And then within a year or so was made the chief of nursing services. That was during the draft. And, you know, in today's world, everybody's there because they want to be. Nobody's there because they were drafted. But it was so such an experience. My lab tech was in civilian life, was a lawyer. The non-commissioned officer of nursing services was a mortician. You know, the whole thing was like that. You know, people from...
And they were all drafted.
All drafted. Or, you know, they joined before they were drafted. And a lot of them were from that immediate area. There were a few from Evansville. And when I first joined, the hospital commander was from St. Louis. And the unit at that time had... C-119 aircraft, which they refer to as the flying boxcar. They would fly into the Evansville airport on Friday night, I think like 6 o'clock, and those of us who lived in the area would go out and get on that aircraft, and then they'd go to St. Louis to pick up the hospital commander and a couple people, and then we'd go back, fly to Columbus. And at that time, I think I weighed like 98 pounds. And the regulation then was anybody on the aircraft had to have a parachute on. Well, I couldn't even stand up once they got it on me. And the plane rattled and shook and made so much noise, I didn't know when we were taxiing and when we were in the air. And I said, you know, there's no need to put that parachute on me. I am not jumping out of this airplane. Well, of course, I was the only woman on there. And they said, ma'am, you'll be the first one out. I said, only if you push me. But I didn't have sense enough to be afraid. You know, it was...
Just part of your job?
Well, you know, just a part of it. But so, I met my husband in the reserve.
What year was that?
Sometime after 68. We married in 71. And... anyway, I got my engagement ring under the wings of a Fairchild C-119.
Oh, neat.
I found the picture of that the other day. I guess he took the picture after he gave me the ring. But so, when we got married, it was so new to, you know, used to, you couldn't be married and be in the military, period, any branch. And it was so new that they didn't know how to do the paperwork. We went to personnel to get my name changed and that. And they didn't know what form to even use. That took a while. And we found that some of the men were angry at him because all of a sudden, you know, there was this other person in the one of us kind of thing. We had some school teachers in the group that could get kind of rowdy away from home on the weekend. You know, I was very protected because they weren't going to risk their career to do anything untoward, you know. But it was a real learning experience for some of them.
Was your husband at that point a higher rank than you, or the mm-hmm. same higher mm-hmm. rank? Mm-hmm. What rank was
he? I think
he
was... I don't know if he was a... He must have been a major... at the time.
In the Air Force Reserve also?
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Now, he had been in since ROTC at UK.
Oh, okay.
And he'd been on active duty at, I think he was at Wright-Patterson, and spent a year in Okinawa. Like I say, all of a sudden, they were leery of you know, how much we knew and how much we'd talk when we got... Of course, we didn't know, I don't think... after we were married, anybody lived in the vicinity that we knew. But they made it difficult for him, to the point that we later transferred to the Kentucky Air National Guard from the Columbus. It was back when they started trimming back the military, you know, Vietnam had ended, and so they were cutting numbers, equipment, everything. So they closed the base at Columbus and transferred us all to Grissom Air Force Base in Kokomo, just north of Kokomo, Indiana.
Yeah.
Well, that was a 5-hour trip from Frankfort. You know, it'd take y'all a week to get ready to go, and then we'd leave as early as we could on Friday afternoon. Both of us were working full-time jobs for state government. And we'd get back late on Sunday night, and then, you know, it'd take y'all a week to get over it then.
Was that once a month that you
right.
Typical reserve
mm-hmm.
time?
And then 2 weeks out of the year.
Summer, right.
Mm-hmm. That's when I took up golf. I thought, I've got to find something that I can do with all these guys for 2 weeks. One of the other things that stand out in my mind is to the gender difference. The hospital, and probably all the other units too, but anyway, they'd have a picnic sometime during that 2 weeks of annual training, and I would go to the cookout. It was always on base, but after we ate, they would sort of figure out a way to invite me to leave so they could watch their girly flicks. And, you know, today's world, that would never fly, you know.
True.
That's a big no-no. But even that, you know, I didn't think anything about it. I didn't feel discriminated against. It was something they'd done for longer than I'd been around. And, you know, of course, I didn't have any desire to see the movies either. But, you know, that's just the way life was.
When you went to those kind of events, were you and your husband in the same unit?
Yes, he was the engineering commander, and I was in the hospital.
So,
you know, if the whole, it was called a group at the time, if the whole group had an activity, then, you know, we were in the same meeting or whatever it was.
So you all spent a lot of that weekend time together in terms of meetings or anything
it,
going
it
on?
It varied. You know, in the hospital, you do shots and physicals consume the most of your day in training. So, you know, we maybe would, well, I don't think we even saw, they had a mess hall on base, but the hospital group tended to, you know, we'd drive into town and have lunch because we generally would be going late, haven't gotten through the morning. And you know, the difference in each organization's role and all that, you know, just didn't match up. So, no, I didn't necessarily see him in the daytime. Of course, I'd been in a while before I ever knew. I knew who he was because he was one of the commanders. But as far as seeing a lot of him.
Not really.
Mm-mm.
And you guys transferred to the Kentucky Guard. What year was that?
Air National Guard, 73. Yeah.
So you've been with that, with this particular unit, you were with them the rest of the time that you were in?
Well, I joined in 73. I had to go through the process again, take a second oath to the Guard, the Air Guard, like I'd taken to the Air Force Reserve. And I did that. Their headquarters office was here in town somewhere. I don't recall which building now. I know where it was. It's in the old highway department building, right?
Up the hill?
Yeah.
The arsenal?
No, the old highway department. I don't know what's there now. The one that was a prison at one time.
Oh, yeah. So their offices were all located
mm-hmm.
in that building?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
At the main headquarters for the Kentucky Guard. Anyway, I went down to this colonel's office and took an oath, and as I lowered my hand, he said, "That makes you chief nurse of the TAC hospital at Louisville." And I said, "But they have a chief nurse." And he said, "But they want you." And I thought, gosh, I've stepped in it and I've not even gotten started, which was the first hurdle to overcome. They hadn't bothered to tell the their current chief nurse that I was going to replace her, which took a few years to overcome.
Did you continue to work with her?
Oh, yes. And we worked out something eventually that I've forgotten what her background was in addition to nursing, but she had, we finally managed to move her to, she was still assigned to the hospital, but she came one of the environmental officers. And, you know, we worked out things. I tried to accommodate her feelings, and you know that's not a good feeling, and I felt like that was really unfair to both of us. But it was a pretty dysfunctional system when I walked in. They had stacks and stacks of what used to be the computer cards with the holes punched in it for immunizations, and nobody knew which cards were for shots to be given and which had been given. And so, you know, I streamlined that. Their physicals were taken like the better part of a weekend for one person. And I broke that down to where I think it was taking 45 minutes after a while. Just a lot of, you know, just management kinds of things. My strong point was management in addition to my psych nurse background.
Did you have a lot of good people to work with?
Yes.
So that helped you streamline it, obviously.
You know, and that was just the beginning of changes. For example, weight had not been an issue, and I had a nurse that worked for me that was she wasn't close, she was overweight, and they started coming down on that, and she approached me one day and she said, "Well, I know I'm going to be okay since we're friends." And I said, "No, you don't know that. Yes, we are friends, but you're going to have to meet the weight standard. I can't and won't cover for you." And she ended up leaving the unit. And you know, since I joined in 1968, things gradually, you know, like everything else, began to evolve. That particular unit had not been, they hadn't networked with a lot of other units. They didn't get involved on a national level. We started going to attending the Association of Military Surgeons of the United States, which is all the military medical professions of all services, active and reserve. Had a conference once a year, so
and what's that called again?
Association of Military Surgeons of the United States.
Does that still exist?
Oh yes. I've been probably twice since I retired. The longer you're retired, the less interested you are. Well, and the people that you knew, you know, they've retired. The people are different. Even the Louisville unit, I go back there. I don't know anybody anymore.
Well, it's like any work you do, once you get out of it, you know, the people start. It just, that's the way life is, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Of the hospitals and all that you worked with or in, do you have a favorite? Speaking of the Louisville one, do you feel like there's a particular one that you made the most difference in or enjoyed the most or any of the above?
Well, it's kind of a mixture. Of course, I have a soft spot in my heart for the Kentucky Air Guard, since I was also, sometime after I arrived there, was the Assistant Adjutant General for Air, which is probably the best military job I had ever, and that's when I got my first star. Prior to that, I was the first nurse commander of a tactical hospital unit in the Air National Guard. But still, you know, it's I've gotten through more glass ceilings in my career than I would have ever thought about, because I didn't see it that way. You know, my attitude was I wanted to do a good job, didn't matter what my gender was. I didn't use it, didn't want any job because of it, and just wanted to go in there, get the job done, and get it done well. So when I became the hospital commander, by that time I'd been promoted to lieutenant colonel, And prior to that, it always had to be a flight surgeon or a physician who had to be in those roles. Well, they changed it. But what they didn't change was that was a full colonel position. I could hold the position, and anybody liked me, but we couldn't be promoted to full colonel. I was fortunate enough. By that time, I'd figured out that it was very important to network with other states and other people. I became friends with a couple of nurses from other states, networked with them, went to their variety of military correspondence schools you have to take, and so I got through all of those and went to the, by that time they had formed an organization called the Fraternity of Air National Guard Nurses. Matter of fact, I'm a charter member of that. And, you know, we kind of shared what worked, what didn't work. Was asked to serve as because of having been one of the first, or the first TAC hospital commander to serve on a group that the director of the Air Guard had put together and make recommendation to him, which I think then went to the chief of the Air Force, for women and gender issues and what needed to be changed. Well, one of the first things, of course, was to allow women to serve in non-traditional assignments. The other was to allow women, nurses, to serve in the positions like I was in, but to allow us to be promoted just like anybody else if we met the criteria. We had 12 different items, and I was able to see all 12 of those items accomplished. We established what we thought was an acceptable percentage of females in the Air National Guard. And I remember debating whether it ought to be 9% or 12% or what. But we exceeded that percentage within, say, a five-year period of time. But to be able to serve on a group like that and then to see the recommendations actually accomplish, you know, it's just phenomenal.
Oh, it's amazing.
When I was hospital commander.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned TAC hospital. Exactly what does that mean?
I knew you were going to ask me that. It's tactical hospital. In the Guard, there were clinics and hospitals, and Louisville Air Guard just happened to be a hospital. A hospital was, I don't remember the difference in mission, but a hospital had a greater number of people and more, a larger variety of the kinds of, the different physicians we had. At one time, we had nurse anesthetist in our particular organization. And a clinic was normally smaller than that, and it had to do with your wartime mission. Like a wartime mission, we would go to a specific location and function in their hospital. And the clinics were more, as I recall, it's been so long ago, more oriented to outpatient care and what they would do.
Is this part of the VA system, the TAC hospital, part of the VA system itself?
I don't think it's part of the military system. Now, all that's changed, and it's a medical squadron or a medical group. And it part
but it
of
wasn't back then.
I see. Part of it's a numbers thing, and
was the VA hospital in Lexington? Has it been there since you've been in the military, and the one in Louisville too?
Mm-hmm. We finally, there was no connection since we were a weekend operation. We used to do a lot of physical exams for the induction center at Louisville for new draftees or new inductees, I guess now. We used to do their physicals. And then before I left as hospital commander, we'd established a relationship with the VA hospital at Louisville where we would send some of our people out to be trained at their facility. Of course, it took a big contract and forever to negotiate, but we finally did get it worked out just as I left as
a hospital. Did you feel like that was a huge step in the right direction to get them working together?
Well, it was, you know, but it was an uphill battle in those days, even with the active duty. You know, they didn't recognize us. They depended on us if we went to war, but they didn't recognize us normally as being a part of the operation. Really didn't. I don't think they understood what we were, and I'll never forget when we were still at when we were at Grissom, I guess it was. I had become the chief nurse, and so I called the chief nurse. We were there for 2 weeks training. I said I'd like for my men to come down and spend some time on the wards and get some training and do some work, and I'll come down, you know, in a half an hour. There's something I have to complete, but I will send them, here's how many are coming and so forth, and I'll tell them, you know, who should I tell them to report to? So they told me, finished what I was doing, I went down, and to a person, they were mopping the floors or something of that nature, and I just, you know, was so upset. I didn't say anything. I said, boys, put your mops down and come with me. If we're going to do training, you know, I'm pretty sure all of you know how to mop a floor. We'll go do our own training. This is not what I sent you down here for. Pull them all out. Well, finally, we eventually worked that out a little bit. But the VA, when we worked, it was, of course, several years later, when they did go, they worked out a pretty good system for us, and they were, you know, trying to make things work. But it's tough when you don't know people, things, whatever.
Did you find that the people at the VA tended to be real territorial, you know, as opposed to helpful? Or,
well, I think they just didn't know what to expect. They'd never dealt with us before. You know, we'd never dealt with them before.
More being leery.
It was new to everybody. You know, just like the active duty from our host base at one time when I was the commander was... and the chief nurse was the Air Force Base at Tyndall Air Force Base in near Panama City, Florida. And we did, when we were going for 2 weeks, we'd make a preliminary visit. The hospital commander, the chief nurse, and a couple other significant staff people. And we'd go down and take our training plan of things we needed to accomplish during that 2 weeks. And try and get to know them and set the framework. And once we started doing that, you know, things worked out a little bit better. I walked in the hospital down there one day, and the chief nurse paged me to come to her office. And somebody on her staff, her assistant or somebody, had given my staff a hard time. And she pointed out that just two of us had more years experience than their whole staff. And, you know, word got out as to what, at that time, I think I was director of the Division of Institutional Care for the Department of Mental Health of Kentucky, and was responsible for all the facilities for the mentally ill, mentally retarded. So she kind of clued them in as to, you know, how that worked and how intimately aware of Joint Commission on Accreditation for hospitals, which their facilities have to be accredited, you know, how much I knew about that and so forth. So, you know, attitudes change. Of course, attitudes are only as good as the people involved.
Sounds as though that once you started making an effort to kind of pave the way and get to know the people initially and all that, that was what it took to kind of lessen the tension maybe between
and, you know, that was a bigger issue to me than any gender issue ever was. Like I say, having grown up and where you stood up if a doctor walked in, you know, that's just fact of life. I didn't question it. I've never worn a chip on my shoulders for us. I'm female, so I deserve something better than what I have. I never wanted it like that. But my networking and that paid off.
Do you feel like in having not having the chip on your shoulder and not, you know, pounding the I'm a woman thing helped you achieve in your career all that you achieved? Mm-hmm. You were there, you were doing the job. Do you feel like that made a difference?
I think, yes, attitude had everything to do about it. I didn't feel like anybody owed me anything. I wanted what I earned, but I didn't want anything further than that. The last years of my career, I was on a lot of committees and boards, and there was an African-American man from Washington, D.C., that we kidded between ourselves that the woman and the black man filling their square on all these committees. But even he, too, you know, we felt like we had something to contribute as individuals, not as he is the black man and me is the woman. You know, we felt like we could make good contributions and went on with it, you know, because she, of course, I'm a don't make waves kind of person. I want the job done and I'm going to follow through to see that it gets done. And people soon learn that. When I became hospital commander, the girl who had been my assistant chief nurse said, you know, you're not aggressive enough to be a commander, said, you know, you really are too quiet in that. And I said, so I had a commander's call, and I said, you know, I've been accused of, I need to be more aggressive, and I don't normally talk loud, but let me clue you into one thing. Whether you can hear me or not, if my face gets red, you better be moving. but, you know, my philosophy has been to, even in my civilian life, back in my days as a charge nurse of the psych unit, was I never asked my people to do what I would not do myself. And people soon learn that. As commander, if my people were, as hospital commander, if I was sending people to the field, I was right out there with them, whether I wanted to be or not. You know, if I asked them to go, then I should be willing to go too. I sent the group, as I said, you know, the training requirements increased as every year went by. We were close to Fort Knox from Louisville, so we went to Fort Knox. The medics had to go for overnight training at Fort Knox. And so I did the day at the hospital in Louisville on Saturday, you know, just the routine commander's meetings and that. That night, at the end of that day, somebody drove me out to wherever they were in the field at Fort Knox. I slept on a cot in a tent with the rest of them. They kept saying after we ate, when's she leaving? When's she leaving? Well, they may have wanted to party once I left, but they were all surprised to find that I didn't just come for the cookout for dinner and then leave. I, you know, that was a pet peeve when I was an underling. And, you know, I didn't feel like I was any better than they were, but you would be amazed at the amount of respect I gained for the fact that I slept in that tent, or I spent the night in the tent. The tanks of Fort Knox were firing all night long, and about the time I dozed off, those things would go off.
And what year was that?
Oh, gosh.
Do you remember? Even close?
Let's see. I think I became hospital commander in 82, so it was...
Give or take.
In that area.
What, of all the bases that you've been on, can you remember all of them? Can you remember the names of all of them or what you did?
No, because, you know, my primary assignment once I left the Air Force Reserve was the Louisville base. So anything we did was like a two-week period of time. It wasn't a two-year assignment because I had a career in state government at the same time. What is interesting that a lot of people can't understand was that I was always closer to the people I worked with 2 days a month than the ones I worked with 5 days a week. I said that one time to somebody I worked with in state government, and they just couldn't believe that. And I said, well, in that environment, you know, it's 2 days a month and 2 weeks out of the year. But, you know, we'd been to England and some different places. But you, in the military, in certain situations, you work, you play together, you look after each other. You know, a camaraderie develops that, you know, a 8 to 4:30 job, you know, 4:30 everybody goes home and rarely sees each other until 8 o'clock the next morning. And it's just, you know, looking after each other and traveling together miles at a time. You just, you know, it's just a thing you do.
You feel like your military experience overall just built the kind of relationships that you wouldn't have had you not been in the military then?
Probably. You know, my husband said one time, you know, we've gone places that we would never have considered going had it not been for the military. You know, I was on a committee called, I want to say it was the Executive Planning Council, that was made up of mostly generals and executive officers, and, you know, it was part of the planning for the whole of the Air National Guard to input to that. And we met in some weird places that, like I say, you wouldn't go frequently, sometimes on bases, but several times at hotels, you know, conference center or something. The first one of those I ever went to after I got my first star, I was a brand new general, and we were in Nevada. And I got on the elevator that morning to go down to the meeting room, and there were like three or four generals got on with me, none of whom I knew. They obviously didn't know me. It was interesting. Some looked at me in the face, looked at my shoulder, and turned their head. Probably one out of three looked at me, looked at my shoulder, and spoke, and, you know, how's your day? How are you?
Did you think you encountered resentment from the ranks or the rank and file or whatever because you did, you know, you're in your career, you accelerated and achieved all that rank?
Well, for the most part, people were pleased that, you know, I was pretty much well-liked, but people were glad to see people get, you know, see me get ahead, not just me, anybody like me. You know, they knew I worked hard. I wouldn't ask them to do anything I wouldn't do myself, and they were pleased. When I was appointed hospital commander, 2 weeks after I was appointed, we went to Germany to participate in some NATO exercises. The whole wing went. And I thought, boy, what an initiation. We had everything from, at that time, the Air Guard unit flew F-4s. Well, we hadn't been there a few days until I was paged at the hospital at Zweibrücken Air Force Base, I believe, in Germany. And I was paged to come to the emergency room. Well, I went down. Well, there'd been an F-4 that had crashed, but they didn't know if it was from our unit or from the Germany, the Air Force Active Duty unit. And, you know, standing there not knowing, that was an experience. I had three medics that were in a bar downtown one night, and a guy approached them asking about the number of aircraft we had there from Kentucky, wanting to know about the tail numbers on the aircraft. Well, that just scared them to death, you know. And when we went, it was just within days after there had been a bombing of some military guys at an outdoor cafe in Munich. So it was not good times, and we had some intercepted threats, you know, while we were there. But anyway, that we had to notify the OSI and you know, that kind of thing.
Did they find the guy that had been asking all the questions?
They did. I wasn't at a rank then. They didn't
to know.
They didn't tell me that. I don't know that anybody was ever reported, you know. And that was before all the you know, we were tuned in to all the terrorist possibilities and that, even though by the time we got to Germany, because of the Munich thing and I don't know what else had gone on at that time, they had set up the, you know, the big concrete things they put in medians, like when they're working on the road. Well, they staggered those at the entrance to bases at that point in time. So, you know, you couldn't drive straight through a gate. You had to go.
And like, what year was that actually started?
I think that was 1988.
Wow. So that's been a while back, mm-hmm. too. But things were already stirring even back then, weren't they?
Well, I guess so. You know, we had the Munich thing, and I don't, unfortunately, don't remember the details of all that. But, you know, we had a three-day weekend, and we were called together before the start of it. We were there for the 4th of July, I believe it was, and we were called and sit together as a wing and told that, you know, there had been some traffic that's been intercepted, that there may be something directed toward the military, and so anyway, nobody in my hospital unit was allowed to go away anywhere on their own, and I made them all sign out who they were going with and where they were going, and I gave them a time that they had to be back on Sunday, and it all turned out.
Nothing happened,
but, you know, it was probably not the most restful weekend we had had, but that was my first heads up to, you need to know what's going on around you. And, you know, I guess from then on, things kind of picked up, maybe. From the hospital commander position, they established three new positions for nurses as colonel positions, full colonel. I was lieutenant colonel at the time. Meantime, I had befriended a couple ladies that were older in age and time and grade, so they kind of mentored me, and I had some hours toward my master's degree. And when we went for promotion, we were competing also with full-time active duty folks.
Oh, really?
And they said, you know, as a nurse, you've got to get your master's degree. So I took 18 hours at night and finished my master's degree. And
what year was that? Just approximate.
In the 80s, maybe 88, thereabouts. They both called one day at my office here in town and said, you need to be ready to respond. We think you're going to be selected. You act fat, dumb, and happy when it when it happens, but, you know, that was, let's see, I graduated with my graduate degree in May, so it was soon after that. So I was selected as they were called Air National Guard Assistant positions, and I was the first Air National Guard Assistant to, I think it might have been the Tactical Air Command. It changed shortly thereafter to the Air Combat Command, which still exists. It's Langley Air Force Base. And so I was assigned to the Surgeon General's office there to the Chief Nurse of the Air Combat Command. And my role was to, of course, I had to spend a little bit of time in their offices, but my major responsibility was, there are a number of different commands, and so my role was to visit the Air Guard units that fell under the Air Combat Command, visit their hospitals and clinics, and do what they called staff assistance visits. You know, even the reserve and the guard have inspections, and you either pass or you're out of luck kind of stuff. So it was my role to go around, do staff assistance visits with sometimes an active duty team, sometimes a team from the headquarters, the guard headquarters in Washington. And I should have kept track, but, you know, I was forever getting calls saying, oh, thank you, because of you, we got an excellent, or we got an outstanding, or we passed. There was one unit that was on the verge of being just going down the tubes. They had failed like three. Wow. And they called me one Sunday. Burns and I were on our way out the door to church. They called from California to say that they'd had their outbrief and they had gotten an excellent or some, at least a satisfactory, you know, it was anybody's guess as to which way it was going to go. And, you know, that was a good payoff. That assignment was, I was in that assignment during Desert Storm. And my civilian boss in state government and my husband, you know, I had talked to them at Langley, said, you know, what I plan on here? And they said, well, you know, be prepared to come here full time. You know, that's probably what we'll do first. If you get activated, we'll pull you up to Langley to help us up here. Well, one night about 9 o'clock, the phone rang, and it was my Langley boss, the chief nurse at Air Combat Command, and she said, we have been in meetings this afternoon, and we want you, the Air Force Reserve, and the Air National Guard, want you to represent them and go out to the bases in Arizona, one in Phoenix, one in Tucson. So we've got people that have been activated to both places in the hospitals. We've got big-time trouble. We don't know what the problem is. You don't even have to fix it. Just go out there and see what's going on. So when people ask me if I got sent to the desert, I got sent to the Arizona desert. Went out in February, and they said, when go do that. I think they sent me for 2 or 3 weeks.
Was it a mess when you got there?
Oh, yes. And they said, while you're out there, we'll be working on a schedule for you to go to the other places that were having similar issues. But those two are the biggest concern right now. So I went out. I was not promoted yet to full colonel. I was still lieutenant colonel. But I went out, and they had activated people from the Air Force Reserve has what they call IMAs. I forgot what the I stands for, but it's a mobilization augmentee, which means the chief nurse or a nurse at, say, the OR charge nurse at the hospital at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base had a reserve person assigned to her that she could go in and take over her job. And then some of those people were sent to Desert Storm. Well, it had been over a holiday weekend that they'd gotten activated, and a lot of these mobilization augmentee people, they'd sent them out there. Some of them even couldn't, the bank wasn't open when they left to even get money. And then they got out there and the bases weren't prepared for them. And, you know, then they'd try to call personnel people back that they answered to at AFRES, and you know, they weren't getting answers. Some of them hadn't gotten paid. A couple of them had major one had major heart condition, and one of them had major psychiatric issues, and you know, that should have been dealt with before they ever got there. Just a variety of stuff, you know. And I did that for 2 weeks. Of course, by the time I got my report written, the war was over, so I didn't go anywhere else. But, you know, I was fortunate in that my civilian job and my military roles complemented each other. You know, I had been responsible for a lot of facilities in Kentucky and had gotten to the point where, you know, I could walk in and size up a situation and what the problems were pretty well. It's to me, it's easy to go in and see what's wrong. It's another issue to have to fix it. So that put it on a little different light. But I was, you know, also didn't want to end up with egg on my face as to what kind of report I wrote. So I hope to tell you, I put a lot of thought into those reports. But you know, I encountered such things as there was a nurse anesthetist from, I forgot where she was from, full colonel. And I said, you know, you're not new in this business. You've been in you've been an IMA for years. You know, didn't you knew surely that this could happen. You know, you were told that up front. That's just a part of how, what the reserve is about. She said, yeah, but I didn't think it would ever happen. So, you know, that's what we were dealing with. And then they were treated shabbily. And then somebody hadn't done their job as far as screening out the one with the heart condition and the one with the medical problems and that. And
sounds like you had your hands full.
Well, you know, I let it be known that I wasn't there to fix anything. I would get the word back. You know, there was no excuse for the personnel office not to be responding to their concerns and that. But anyway, I went back, did the report, and my name became known a lot of places because of what I picked up on. What I did was listed the issues, and I think I made recommendations as to, you know, I don't remember if I was allowed to make recommendations or not, but I was pretty specific as to what the issues were.
Did you become known as someone to send places to find out what the problem was?
I assume so. You know, use that report. The military has, after anything that it would be a training or an active duty episode or whatever, you know, when we ever get out of Afghanistan and Iraq, there'll be a lessons learned thing. And it's very helpful, you know. It kind of outlines what went wrong and, you know, how do we not let that happen the next time, which is a very good approach. But anyway, that was a 3-year assignment that was coming to close, and so I was going to retire. And the chief of the Air Force Nurse Corps said, I've asked for you to be assigned to my office. And I said, oh, really? And she said, but they would only agree to 6 months. She said, I talked to the director of the National Guard Bureau. Her office was at Bowling Air Force Base in D.C. And she said they would only agree to 3 months because they said they had plans for you. And I said, the only plans I know of is I'm retiring, you know, when I leave your office. Well, 3 months after that, we were in Mississippi at a National Guard Association conference. And the Adjutant General of Kentucky said that afternoon they had what was called an all-states dinner. It's a formal dinner, and all the states' representatives are there. So we got to there, to the hall where that was, and he said, come over here a minute. Let me talk to you. And he looked me in the eye, and he said, we want to appoint you as the Assistant Adjutant General for Air for Kentucky. And I looked him in the eye, and I said, I'm not interested in being your token female. And I thought, this may be a short offer. He said, looked me just straight in the eyes. He could, didn't crack a smile. He said, that's not got nothing to do with it. He said, at this point in time, you're the most qualified for the job, and we want you. And there were a couple reasons that he said, now, you know, for these reasons, I have to ask you to keep it in the family. Burns was with me at this formal dinner. And he said, you know, I have to ask you to keep it to yourself until we can release it. But he said, you know, we would like to do that.
And what year was this?
90. Okay. 80, 89 or no. It was 94 maybe. I've got my bio with all those.
Doesn't matter, just generally.
Anyway, we'd flown out there on military air. Well, I went back to the table and sat down. And I know my face was beet red. My chief of staff was sitting to the right, or a friend of ours, he was later my chief of staff, was sitting on the right of me, and he kept looking at me kind of funny, and I knew my face was just beet red. And I was finally able to lean over to Burns and give him the essence of what was going on. And so anyway, we got back to Louisville. We'd flown out there on a C-130. We got back to Louisville, And they literally met my airport. We got back like on a Thursday maybe. They met the airplane, and a couple people in Louisville were in the know, and they said, "General, or Colonel, you have to go to Washington and be there Monday for a general officer physical." And I told Burns, I said, "My blood pressure will absolutely be sky high. I'll never pass that physical." And he said, "Well, I'll just go with you." So he walked me to death that weekend. We went up, I think, on Saturday. And so we had Sunday before my physical on Monday. At that point in time, as a general officer, you had to go to an active duty base for a physical. I could not get it done by my own unit in Louisville, and that, you know, that stands to reason. But we laugh for a long time about starting to jump through the hoops. And from then, you know, the next day I had to get a picture, an official picture, and there's all this package. And you know, it takes forever, and you just... You know you're never, it's never going to happen, and all this kind of stuff.
Well, what did Burns think about all this?
He was excited. When I finally, the promotion went through, at that point in time, you had to do a 2-week, what we used to call charm school. They flew you and your spouse to Washington, and you were there for a week. And then they flew the spouses home, and the rest of us, we flew around the country at different Air Force command, major commands, and were given briefings on those commands and what they did and what was going on. And they usually had a dinner of some sort for us and that sort of thing. And, of course, there was a nurse from the Air Force Reserve that was there part of the time, and me as the only one in the Air Guard. But just about to a person, I forget how many people were in that class. The men, after that first week in Washington, the men came up to me and said, "We really admire your husband." Said, "Given a change in circumstances, I don't know if I could do that or not." And I said, "Well, you can't have it both ways. If he had a problem with it, either I wouldn't be here or we wouldn't be married. It, you know, you just can't have it both ways. I couldn't function that way. He wouldn't be happy at home." And he had retired by that time, so he could travel with me. He didn't do the back-to-back trips. I had a lot of those. I packed for as many as 5 trips at a time. With, you know, I'd have like a day between
sure
at home. But the very first day we were there, we went to the Pentagon for a briefing by the, I think it was supposed to have been by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs or Department of Defense secretary, I forgot which. Anyway, it was the vice chair, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that was giving us a briefing and going to welcome us and all. And he started out with saying, "I looked at the attendance roster," and he said, "This is quite an illustrious group." He said, "I noticed the tag from Kentucky is here." Said, "Sir, would you raise your hand?" I thought, "Oh, Lord, I'm the A tag, not the tag." And so I just sat there, and I thought, you know, how do I get out of this? Something's going to have to give. And he said, "Sir, please raise your hand." So I raised my hand, and the room just roared, and his face got beet red. The chief of staff of the Air Force was in the back of the room. And that night, we went to his house for it was all active duty Air Force Reserve, and Air Guard general officers. We went to his house for a reception, and as Burns and I went in the door, he said, "Well, Verna, your buddy just left here." He said, "He lives right across the street. He's my neighbor." And I said, "You know what, sir? If that bothered me, I wouldn't be here." He said, "Well, that, I admire you for that." I said, "I have no business being here if I can't handle that." I said, it was an innocent thing, and I don't, you know, I would have been glad to have spoken with him. But I laughed. I said, you know, he did me a favor. The chief of staff of the Air Force got to know me on first name basis in just one day's time. And we actually later hosted he and his wife in Louisville, and he commented we were in a car going somewhere that they had scheduled for us. And he said, well, Verna, I know it's been an uphill battle for you and your career, but hopefully you're paving the way that in years to come, it'll be just status quo, or just another day of business for women coming behind you. But he said, I admire you for having done what you've done.
That's a wonderful thing to say. Well, you know,
you can't get any better compliment than that.
You want to take a little break?
Yeah, well, boy, how's that for timing?
Okay, we just took a break. We're coming back. It's still December 15th, 2009, talking with Major General Fairchild. We kind of left off where you were given that huge compliment about maybe you paved the way for other women in the military. And you must hear that a lot.
Well, I do. And I, as a retiree, I'm retired, but I feel like I still have a responsibility to pay back, 'cause the military was good to me. Aside from the money, I get a nice check every month from them, but the people you meet, you know, one of the problems Burns and I encounter now that the bulk of our friends are scattered around the United States, but the people you meet, the responsibility never seemed overly overwhelming to me. It was an ongoing challenge, but the people you meet and the experiences you have. As the assistant AG for Air, once I retired from state government in 97, that freed me up. You know, my husband said, that's the fullest part-time job I've ever seen in my life. But our the 123rd Airlift Wing, the engineering group, a part of it, had been sent to Morón Air Base in Spain to help do some engineering projects that they needed done. And that happens to be a base that gets involved in the space program when they have a shuttle. They're on notice, and NASA people are there, and they have equipment there, which, you know, I didn't know I went over there. But anyway, they wanted me to go over and see what our engineers had done and that. And on the way, it's such a long flight, so we had to stop overnight at the Azores, and that is absolutely one of the most beautiful places. Not some place I'd want to live, understand, but one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen in my life. It's a little island, and you're surrounded by water, but just beautiful. And I ask if there was a theft problem, because, you know, the air base is just a part of that whole island, the locals and that. Their farm plots were divided by a stack of stones, you know, and some of them weren't as big as this room, but that was their farm plot. But anyway, in a part of the conversation about the island, I said, is there a theft issue, or what's the crime rate? And they said, well, once in a while, somebody will steal some candy bars out of one of our vending machines at night. But they said the biggest thing is chain link fence. They said they'll just cut a section of chain link fence out. And I don't think they'd ever figured out what they did with it, but that struck me as so funny.
What on earth, you know,
I don't know. I was able to go more than one trip to Ecuador. That was our partnership nation, the Guard before the current war started, had a pretty well-developed program that is still in existence, but, you know, it's had to step back a few notches because of manpower involved in the OEF, IEF. We had Ecuador. I've forgotten what some of the other nations had, but we went over, we built schools, nurseries.
And what year was this?
The 94, probably. 93, 94.
And that program's still in existence?
I don't know how often, if Kentucky's been recently, because they've had so many people, Army and Air Guard. It was a joint thing, Army and Air Guard, Kentucky Air Guard. But one of our first visits, we went commercial air and stayed in Quito. And, of course, there was me and the adjutant general at the time, his wife went. But then there were six other Army officers that went. And I was, of course, being female, I was the first one off the airplane in our group. Well, in Ecuador, they just had the big stairs, you know. They don't have the tramway thing or whatever you call it, jetway. And I got out the door of the airplane on this platform before I went down the steps. And at the bottom of those steps, there was a group like that. There were like seven guys in black jumpsuits and flak jackets, and they were AK-47s or something like that, you know. And I turned around and started back in the airplane. I thought, oh my, we've really stepped in. And the command sergeant major from the Army was with us. And he and I had sat together on the airplane. He said, no, they're for us. So I went on down the steps, but they were literally standing there guarding us. And they, instead of us going in the terminal building, they took us to some building behind there, and they had nice refreshments spread out. They took our passports, got done whatever needed to be done, collected our luggage, you know, what little bit of customs we went through to get into their country, they took care of in that building. But anyway, we looked out, but this time it was after dark, I don't know, 7-8 o'clock probably. And in our entourage, there was a police car with two policemen, I think. They had their light and their siren on. Behind that was a car full of what we would call plain suits or maybe Secret Service. And then they had us in a van, and then behind us was a big black Suburban with the guys with the AK-47s, and behind that was an ambulance.
Oh!
We thought, oh, wow. And we were in a 5-star hotel, just an elegant hotel. You couldn't drink or use the water, even to brush your teeth. I used more bottled water in that week than I've ever used in my life, probably. But I looked out after we had gotten checked into our rooms, and my room was the closest to the lobby on the floor that we were on. And I looked out the little peephole, and there was all night long at least one person sitting in the lobby there. I looked out the window, and there sat the ambulance all night.
Oh,
geez, I don't know what they expect here. But everywhere we went, it was like that. And the last day we were there, they took the adjutant general and I, his wife and I, asked if we'd like to go shopping. So they took us to some small towns, and one town was known for their woodworking. But the last town we went to was, they had an open-air market. And, you know, I don't have a clue what things they had or what things were worth. Well, one of their Army interpreter was with me, and one of the guys in the black flak jacket. And I would see something I was interested in, and they'd say, it's too much. And so they'd lower their prices. And I thought, if I were these ladies, I'd say, just take it and get out of here. We went to their Department of Defense. And of course, I had a separate meeting with their the director of their Air Force. I've forgotten what his exact title was. But in this building, I guess it was the equivalent of our Pentagon. We went into the building and started up these big wide stairs. Well, as I put my foot up the first step, I was the first one up the steps. These trumpets started blaring. I guess I've really arrived. But they flew us, they took us, they had one Air Force base, and, you know, our base in Louisville was still relatively new, and we've got all the latest in terms of repair equipment and all kinds of technology. And they took me in their maintenance shop, and there was one little black box. I forgot what it was, but, you know, we hadn't used one of those in forever. And the rest of the room was just dark. And they took us over to the hangar, and they had about four aircraft in there. I think one was maybe a Russian or Israel, or they were from other countries other than ours. And they had one of our old C-130s that they had been given by Department of Defense whenever we got new aircraft. And they were saying, well, a problem we have is we can't get spare parts. And as we were talking, we were walking around this C-130, and they said, you know, we can't get spare parts. And I said, well, you know, how can we help you? Well, by that time, we got to the back of the airplane, and the tail of the airplane was propped up on this big stump. I just about lost it. But we did, they had some, El Nino about the time that we were going down there a lot. And so the last couple of times I went, we flew to Panama, and then the Army had taken helicopters down, and then they helicoptered us from the airport there to the area that we were doing the work. One trip, the Army Guard had arranged and took some local Kentucky business people.
To Ecuador?
And we would spend the night in at the, what was it, Clark Air Force Base at Panama. But the one trip that they took them, we went to the Panama Canal, and they were showing us around, and, you know, the room that has all the equipment that controls the gates. Well, I got to open the set of the gates on the canal.
Oh, how neat.
Which was really, really neat. I turned two levers with about seven TV cameras on my hand. But last year, Burns and I finally had a chance and did the Panama Canal cruise and went through the canal. And it was interesting to do after, you know, being
Did you tell everybody on the ship that you had actually gotten to operate some of that equipment?
Yeah, you know, sparingly. But, you know, those things you couldn't buy, you know, if you wanted to, kind of thing.
No, absolutely not.
And like I said, I've probably forgotten more experiences than I ever had. But just I took my sister when they dedicated the Women's Memorial in Washington. I've been involved in the fringes of that, mostly by donating a little money now and then. But I know the lady pretty well that is the director up there. So my sister works for the VA, is a nurse, and I said, you know, you need to go to this with me. So she went up with me, and the morning of that, they picked us up by bus at our hotel, and they had a breakfast for all the female general officers of all services. And it didn't feel a very big room. She has pictures that she took. I made arrangements for her to go and sit in a side room so I could find her. But anyway, then they bussed us from there over to Arlington, where the ceremony was going to be. And they had the Air Force Honor Guard out there and escorted us down front to our seats. And my sister said, I am just in awe. She said, I'm sitting here with my mouth open. And she said, you just act like this is nothing to you. And I said, it's just all in a day's work, Sarah, just another day's work. But she made me feel a little bit guilty that she said, you just take all this for granted. And I said, well, you know, it's what I do. I'm supposed to be here. It's what I do. I represent not only the Air National Guard at that time, but all the women in the Air National Guard and any other service for that matter.
Speaking of big events like that that are just overwhelmingly wonderful, and that sounds like one that would be, is there any one event that you really consider just the epic center of your career that meant more to you than anything?
I don't know. You know, they just all kind of sort of run together.
When you got your second star, was that an event that was, did that mean more than the first star, or was
The first one I actually was pinned on Governor Jones and the Adjutant General, General DeZarn at the time, pinned at the Capitol Rotunda.
Oh, wow.
And that was special. But the second one, you know, I never expected to get the first one, much less the second one. And the second one, you know, I think I said in my speech was that, you know, this is the kind of thing that happens to other people. You know, you don't think about it happening to you. But, you know, people treat, I got a note from the, she was a one star and chief of the nurse corps, Air Force Nurse Corps at the time, sent me a card when I got my first star. And she put a little note in it that your life will never be the same. And I thought, sure it will. But boy, was she ever right. You know, people treat you different. And they treat you even more different when you get your second star. Even my family, when my older sister was living, excuse me, they lived in Florida. So we'd go there usually every other year for Christmas. And the first year after I got my first star, you know, it was like I was supposed to have the biggest bedroom in the house, Burns and I, and something else. And I said, whoa, you know, I haven't changed. I wear a different rank on my shoulder. I'm still the same person. I'm still your sister, the aunt of your children. You know, we're not going to go there, you know. Treat me just like always. And I think they sort of, you know, went through a little period of change. Like I said, I do not come from a military family.
Well, you know, I can appreciate the fact that they were very, very impressed with that. And I'm sure you did, too. Maybe you didn't want them to feel differently about you, per se. But I if I were you, I would really appreciate the fact that they consider that something
well,
really
Well, you know, I did. But I still want to be me.
I can imagine.
And, you know, I don't, it's not something, you know, I'm not certainly not ashamed of being a general officer, but I also don't go down the street saying, you know, hey, we had trouble with my mother when I got my first star. We'd be in a store shopping, and she'd say, my daughter's a general. Well, most of them didn't know what she was even talking about. And we were going to take her to Florida one year. My brother lives there, and my sister's two girls since my sister had died. And so we were going to take her and stay on the beach for a couple of weeks and let them come see us. And so Burns said, you know, you've got to keep her from telling everybody that you're a general. He said, you know, it's going to jeopardize your safety. So I said to her on the way down, I said, Mother, I need to ask you to do me a favor. I said, please don't tell people that we don't know that I'm a general, because you're really putting me at risk when you do that. I said, you know, this is a vacation. I'm not working. I don't have a uniform with me. Yes, I'm still a general, but we don't want to tell those other people. And she never uttered a word.
Well, once you put it that way, that puts it in a different perspective. Mm-hmm. She was just really proud of you.
Well, she was, and I appreciated that, you know. But like I say, a lot of them didn't know. It's amazing what people don't know still about the military. And there's a man that goes to our church that he never figured out that we didn't move to Washington full time because I was assigned there. You know, I felt like I was up there full time. But he never understood that. People still to this day don't understand the difference between active duty, guard, and reserve. You know, I went from 1968 doing 2 days a month, 2 weeks a year. Since probably 1980, that changed so much until the time I retired. There was never a month from that time on that we just did 2 days a month, 2 weeks out of the year, especially my last several years. You know, there was just something all the time. Of course, I was on all those committees, and I spent, as the assistant AG for Air, I was assigned to Kentucky, and that was my major responsibility, but I spent a lot of time in Washington. I was on a couple of the committees, the Human Resources Quality Board and the Planning Council that I referred to a while ago. you know, what it amounts to, it's like anything else. You want to be up there lobbying for if they're passing out new equipment, money, new missions. And so, you know, I prided myself in knowing the right people, being able to know somebody well enough that I could call. At one time, we were, when I first became the assistant AG for air, they were, we had 12 aircraft at the time. They wanted to take away, I think, four of them, maybe. Well, I had my people put together a plan that we'd take four more. You know, we had a new base, we had the facilities, we had the space, and we didn't get four more at that time, but we didn't lose any either. So, you know, it was a never-ending job, yet it's one of the most satisfying jobs I ever did. I used to stand in line at the chow hall at the Louisville unit, and they'd say, "General, you don't have to stand in line to eat." And I said, "You don't understand. This is where I find out what's going on, whose people aren't getting haircuts, whose people aren't shining their boots, wearing their uniform like they're supposed to." I said, "You'd be surprised what you learned standing here." Plus, I got to talk to people, and they got to know me. One of the things I did was I tried to fly, I don't recall how many I flew, but I flew weekend missions with the air crew.
Oh, that's neat.
They were able to tell me what they did. You know, I knew about those, but didn't have any reason before to know what they consisted of exactly. Each Sunday afternoon, my command chief would, I said, "You schedule it, just tell me when it's time to go and come and take me to whatever shop we're going to visit." But we would go to a different location every Sunday of every drill. And I said, "I don't want the commander telling me what they do. I want the NCOs or the enlisted folks to tell me what they do and how they do it and why." And get to know people that way. And then I would come back, you know, I'd make notes as we went by, and then I'd call the commander and say, you know, "How come that isn't fixed?" Or, you know, it was not supposed to be a complaint session. And I managed somehow that it never turned into that. And it was interesting the way a lot of them would skirt the issue, and I'd pin them down and say, you know, "Why don't you have that?" And they were very careful not to, which told me a lot about them also.
Oh, I'm sure.
But I got to know a lot of folks that way. I've been out in the field with the security police, the combat control team, which is the team that goes in and sets up a base, the communications equipment for the rest of the people get there. You know, you have to know those things. I think probably one of the biggest insults I ever got, I was at a meeting in Washington once, and they were talking about the GPS system. And one of my male peers leaned over and said, "Do you know what GPS is?" And, you know, it wasn't as, it was a lot newer then than it is today. But had I not known that he is a nice man and he truly wanted to be sure I knew what they were talking about, but momentarily it just insulted the heck out of me. And I never said anything. But, you know, I could have responded hatefully and probably lost a friend, which I don't feel like we can afford to do. You know, wouldn't have gained anything. I said, "Yes, thank you. I know what GPS is."
Obviously, diplomacy was a good skill of yours when you were moving up through the ranks. Your ability to work with and deal with people on a certain level and show respect. Like, that was showing that guy respect on a, you know, you looked at the big picture of who he was, not just that one comment.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I knew what a kind person he was. But, you know, I'd run a mile to stay out of an argument. The lady who was the, we had a lady in our unit that she was such a fanatic about, quote, women's lib, that she would give somebody, some man, a hard time if they offered to open the door. And one day I was with her and I said, "You know, my husband still opens the car door for me. That suits me fine. You know, I appreciate it. Thank you." You know, what's to be gained by, you know, fussing about somebody holding the door open for you? now the older I get, the more I like it.
Yeah. Well, it just sounds as though you tried to live your military career in a reasonable fashion. I mean, I don't see how you could achieve the rank you did with, you know, flying off the handle and getting crazy about things that don't make any sense. And I just...
Yeah, you can't wear your feeling on your shoulders. You know, again, you have to show people respect and you know, the honor guard in the Air Guard at the time, I had the same honor guard at each of my promotions as well as my retirement. And I loved those guys. And I couldn't even remember some of their names, but they knew me, they respected me, and, you know, you could ask those people to do anything for you, and they would. And you know, it's in that situation, it's everybody. It's not just the officer at the top. You know, he can't do his job if those under him don't work out. I had a young captain. He was a pilot or navigator when I was assistant for air, and came to my office one day, and he was upset that he felt like he had been turned down for promotion, and I don't remember what he said, but I don't think he even used the word discrimination. And I said, well, let me check into it and I'll get back to you. So I sent my ops person over to the flight operations. I said, you know, see what's going on here. Why, sharp guy. And it kind of boiled down to he had a conflict between his civilian job and his flying job. And, you know, that's something that you deal with almost everybody on an ongoing basis. As much as the op tempo had increased over the years. And he came back and told me what he found out, and he said, I, you know, it smells a little bit. And I said, well, get that guy back over here, and I want him to meet the promotion board again today. So I called the guy over, said, you know, I'm not sure what went on, but you're going to meet the board. Well, he got upset. He said, all I have with me is this flight suit, and the requirement was you met the board in your Class A dress uniform. I said, well, I have the authority to override that. You show up at the promotion board at whatever time it was in your flight suit. I will let them know that I sent you there that way. And I had a board that met and recommended to me who be promoted, who not be promoted. And it came back that their recommendation was to promote. So I called him back, and, well, they told him, you know, they tell him there, we're going to recommend to the general that you be promoted. I had to sign off on it, and the adjutant general after me. So he came back to my office that afternoon just in tears. He said, I cannot thank you enough. And I said, look, I didn't do anything. You got what you deserve. You know, I just set the wheels, the process. I made the process work like it's supposed to work. But, you know, that didn't take anything extra for me to do.
In doing the right thing, that was, you felt like your job then, right?
Well, it was. And the legal officer that was assigned to headquarters when I was assistant AG, when they built the new base in Louisville, and during that time, the headquarters staff had offices here in Frankfort at Boone Center. So when we were going to move back into the new building at Louisville, he came in. He lives in this area, wanted to stay here and do his weekend time here. And I said, well, first of all, you're no better than I am as far as not driving to Louisville. Secondly, I use my legal people quite extensively, and I want your office, I want you in the office right beside mine. If you don't want to do that or can't do that, then I don't need you. I'll get somebody else. I'll use one of the wing legal people. Well, he started coming down there, and I don't think missed a time after that. But then he grew to appreciate the fact that instead of stepping in something that I shouldn't, I checked with him before I did something that was questionable as to whether it could or should be done. Of course, when I got that first star, one of the first things I learned is to never say, I want, without saying, if it's legal, I want. Because, you know, what you find out are people want to please the general, and they'll, you know, if the general wants and they figure that gives them the license to bypass whatever to make it happen. And so I learned that lesson. Fortunately, not the hard way. I started out that way. But, you know, the military's made up of a lot of really good people. Since the draft ended, everybody's there because they want to be. To a person, they're there because they want to be. Now, they can say what they want, but they join of their own free will. And, you know, they're there because they want to be. And obviously, I've seen a lot of changes over the years.
That's probably something we could talk about another time for a solid hour. Some good, some bad?
Probably most for the good, thankfully. You know, if I had it to do over again, I would probably have made myself smarter on the work, how it all worked. You know, when you finally figured out you're to the extent necessary, you know, you're a major or a lieutenant colonel and on up. But, you know, back when I joined, like I say, there were no other women in the unit that I could go to. Not that my role differed than the men, but, you know, I would have smartened myself up a little bit more than I did rather than learning it over time.
Well, maybe that's a solid way to learn it, though. You know, when you're learning it like that, as you're living it, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't, you know, there's nothing I regret. Like I say, I would have never guessed ever. I was going to quit at the 10-year mark. I told my husband, I said, I had enough of this. I don't need this any longer. I'm just going to quit. And he said, well, you know, another 10 years, you'll have a retirement and get a check every month. So he talked me into it. I think he probably lived a day that I wish I wouldn't have talked her into that when I was gone so much. But like I say, I packed for as many as 5 trips at a time on my last assignment.
It sounds as though he was really supportive, too.
Oh, absolutely. There is absolutely no way. He goes with me when I give a speech, and I always introduce him, number one, and make the point that there is absolutely no way I could have achieved what I did without his support. You know, just the fact that if he weren't with me, I knew he was not sitting home growling because I was not there. I just couldn't have lived with that. It's not a good situation for anybody, but I never had to deal with that.
You know, women in our age bracket and the way that when you started coming up through the ranks and all that, I mean, it was pretty unusual for men to be supportive of women doing anything, mm-hmm. much less achieving mm-hmm. all that you've achieved through time.
Well, he's an open-minded person. You know, he believed in what I was doing, and he supported the fact that I was doing it by working hard and trying to do a good job, and not because I was female and I wanted to show the world that I could do this or that. You know, that just wasn't
him. You were fortunate you married the right person.
Well, yeah, evidently.
You want to stop here and then start up another day?
I need to go.
Okay. We are shutting everything down for the moment, and we'll be back another day.